phenomena, which really is very difficult to understand. A certain metaphor that Chazal used, V'hoya Ekev Tishmon, if you will do the mitzvahs, what mitzvahs are referring to? We're talking, the mitzvahs are called Ekev. Ekev means if, because, but it also means heel of your foot. So V'hoya Ekev Tishmon, if you do the mitzvahs that normally a person would trample with the heel of their foot. Who are we talking about? What kind of people are we talking about that trample mitzvahs, grind mitzvahs into the ground? That's why Rashi says, "Im ekev tishmon, if you do the mitzvahs, kalos, the easy mitzvahs, she'odim dosh ba'kevo, that a person would be prone to trample the ground." That's a very harsh language. To say a person is a little lackadaisical in doing a mitzvah, all right, but to say trample into the ground, what are we talking about? It's a very hard language here. What is the Torah telling us? According to Chazal, that's what according to the sages, that's what the word Ekev means. It's very hard to understand. Also, Chazal tells V'hoya, Ein V'hoya V'loshin Simcha. Some feeling of rejoicing. Also, what's the particular sense over here of rejoicing? Later on in the parsha, we have a very interesting sentence. It tells us that Hashem is lo yisa ponim v'lo yikach shochat. God says, "I am lo yisa ponim. I don't show favoritism, v'lo yikach shochat, and I don't take bribes." God says that about himself. He's lo yisa ponim, no favoritism, and no doesn't take any bribes. So the Talmud asks on this from a, says actually God himself was asked this question by the angels, the Gemara says. That the angels asked him, what are you telling me, lo yisa ponim, that you don't show favoritism? The Kohanim, who speak in God's name, says yisa Hashem ponov ve'lecha, God will show favoritism. Here it says, lo yisa upon him, he will not be no say upon him. And there it says, yisa upon him, he will. Yisa ponov elecha. God will show favoritism. That's the Talmud's question. The Talmud says that the question was asked to the Almighty by the angels. What's God's answer? Something else from this week's parsha. The Torah says, v'yochalta, you should eat, v'savota, and you should be satisfied, uveirachta, and you should bless God. You have to say bench. You have to thank God, grace after meals. So when God was asked, how can you show favoritism to the Jews? He says, how can I not show favoritism? I told them they should eat, be satisfied, and say grace. And they put an obligation on themselves, even if they only have an olive's worth of food, that they also say the grace after the meal. So how can I not show favoritism to them? Why is this the particular mitzvah that the rabbis did that changes whether or not God should be show favoritism? There are many, many rabbinical things. Why is this the particular thing? It's not only that, God is saying, I mean, how can I not show? What is so special about the fact that we say grace after meals, even on a kezias of bread? Why? That's an olive, size of an olive of bread. Why is that so important that say enough to change that even though God says he doesn't show favoritism, that now he has to show favoritism? What compels him to show favoritism? If it's right that God should not show any favoritism, just like it's right he shouldn't take any bribes, so what could in fact make it justified that he should show favoritism? And secondly, why is this the particular thing that should justify showing favoritism? Okay, so those are the questions we're dealing with. The first question was, what does it mean, mitzvahs that somebody tramples? And also, what does it mean, v'hoya is the language of joy? Thirdly, we're asking, what is it that God doesn't show favoritism, and which means it's right, he shouldn't be partial. So then how come anything can make him be partial? And even if something can make him be partial, why is it the fact that we increase, that we say grace even on a small amount, that already means that God can be partial? How can I not be partial? Why? In order to understand this, I'd like to go to another sentence that actually we say on a daily basis in the Kriya Shema. Pasuk says like this, V'hoyim shemo tishmo mitzvosa, if you will adhere to my mitzvahs that I am commanding you today, li'avos Hashem lokechem, to love God. So Rashi, gives us a very interesting definition of love. He says, love, and he's taking it right from the Sifri. Love means that I don't do it so that I should be wealthy. I don't do it so I should become famous. I don't do it so I should get reward. But everything I do out of love. Very interesting definition. Love means not to do anything, to do it unconditionally. Not to expect anything in return. Not money, not fame, not reward. That's the definition of love. But I do it only out of love. That's what Rashi says. That's what he defines love. And then he adds three words, which is not Rashi's own words. This is the end of that Sifri. The Sifri is the halachic medrash on the book of Deuteronomy, of Numbers and Deuteronomy, which means the word is the Talmud itself, is the sages themselves. Add three words. Love means not for money. Love means not for fame. Love means not for reward, but just for the sake of love. And then he adds three words. The sof ha-kovid lovo. But, you know, eventually you'll be rewarded. What is that? He's just pulled the whole rug out of... He's just ripped the whole rug away from it. He's telling you, do it for the sake of love. Stop! What does he now have to tell you? But don't worry. Don't worry, you're going to get rewarded anyway. Right? Even if it's true, it's not part of this definition. This definition is love. Do it out of love. Love means I'm doing it unconditionally. But I'm only doing it out of love. Why does Rashi have to say, but in the end you're going to get a reward? It doesn't make sense. It's like, even if it would be true, it's not the place to say it. He's defining love. I was thinking, in order to understand this, there's another Rashi. The Pasuk says you should, later on in the same volume, Shema, it says like this. You should be very careful not to allow yourselves, Hishamaru lachem pen yifta levavachem, lest your hearts be turned away or from God. Vesartem, and you will stray, vavadtem Elohim acher. You will serve other gods. So Rashi doesn't say the question, but it's obviously bothering. What do you mean, other gods? How can God legitimize other gods? God is telling us that we're going to serve other gods. Other gods means he's legitimizing the other gods. There are no other gods. There's only one God. There's idols, but how do you use the word God on them? So Rashi says the word Elohim Acher, he says, has another meaning. Acher means others, but it also means, Acher means estranged. And Rashi says that they are, that doesn't mean other gods, but Elohim Acher means gods that are estranged. Not estranged, estranged. What does that mean? That people serve them, they cry out to them, and they don't answer them, and they ignore them. Like they don't know them. So Elohim Acher means other gods, doesn't mean other gods, we will serve gods that are estranged from the people that serve them. This is the way Rashi translates that sentence. We will do idolatry here means we will serve gods that you cry out to and ignore you. Rashi in Parshas Yisro says it a little sharper. He says it's that those gods pretend they never saw you before in their life.
But they don't exist anyway, so they can't even see.
But which means that the person who is praying to them gets the feeling that the God is totally ignoring them. So my question is a very obvious question. If it's true that the person that's serving them gets that feeling, why are we so attracted to it? Who wants to go be into a relationship that you're totally ignored? Are you crazy? You know, you talk to someone, they don't even talk to you. They ignore you. Ignoring is worse than screaming at you. Like the worst thing. Here what we're going to do. We're going to go away from God and we're going to get into relationships with gods that totally ignore us. What person in their right mind would get into a relationship with a God that ignores them? And that's the way Rashi says we're going to do. That's the way he translates the sentence. That if we don't listen to the mitzvahs, we will allow ourselves to be seduced and talked into serving other gods and go off the path, who will be totally ignoring of us. Nobody in their right mind will get into a relationship that they're totally ignored. The answer is that's wrong. There's a tremendous attraction for that. Most people are very much, when you serve God or in any relationship, how many times do you hear people say, you know what, I've sacrificed for my children? Do you know how much sacrifice? My son doesn't even talk to me. It's not his fault. It's that woman's fault, of course. It's not his fault that he doesn't talk to me. It's that woman has taken him away from me. There's a tremendous feeling of people feel that the ultimate sense of every relationship is sacrificing. Most religions are predicated on martyrdom. That's like the highest thing, martyrdom, the goal of the religion. I'm not even talking about the religions, but that was part of the regular course of events was slaughtering your children. Human sacrifice. But even if it's not, that's not part of the ongoing observances, which many religions have. There's that mentality that the ultimate relationship with God is sacrificing myself for God. That's the ultimate relationship for God, sacrificing myself for God. And there's a tremendous feeling, I'm more spiritual, I'm more holy, I'm more giving, I'm more perfect. I've sacrificed. And the person, martyrdom is not a small feeling. It's a very uplifting. Listen, people are willing to give their lives for martyrdom. You know, and then there's being a martyr, and then people are martyrs for their children. People are martyrs for their husbands. Many relationships, people will talk about how much they've done. I worked day and night so you could get through school and get a job. Or in the whole time while we were married and had children, I was sacrificed and slaved and worked my fingers to the bone. There's a tremendous feeling of martyrdom. What the Torah is telling us is that it's the totally anti-Jewish feeling. God is telling us here an incredible thing. Love means I do everything unconditionally. I don't want any money. I don't want any fame. I don't want any reward. I'm doing it out of love. But that's not the whole definition of love. There's another component to the definition of love. And that is the sof hakavod lavo. But I know the other person is committed to me. I'm the other person's agenda. When you are in a relationship of giving, 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 and the other person is in the taking, taking, taking mode, then you've destroyed yourself. That's martyrdom. That's not love. You don't love that person. You're sacrificing yourself to that person, which is not love. Love is the feeling of love is ultimately that you have to become stronger and empowered in a loving relationship. Love means that I am doing everything for you, not looking for anything in return. However, I know that I'm involved with a person who all they're thinking about is what they can do for me. Not because of what I've given them, therefore they owe me something. It's not a business. I do nothing. I don't want anything in return. I'm not doing anything on the condition of getting anything back. However, I know 100% that that person is interested in me. I'm that person's agenda. Otherwise, you're not in love. You're not in a loving relationship. Therefore, Rashi, the Sifri, is defining the word love. He's not pulling the rug out from under it. It's exactly the opposite. If you do it not for money, not for fame, not for reward, only for love, that's not love. Unless it's so far covered love, or you know who you're involved with. I know the person involved with is only interested in giving me. If you're involved, let's say, with a narcissist personality, then what you're doing is just letting yourself be eaten up and devoured and sacrificed and becoming a martyr. That's not love. You see, free is defining love. Love means, from my point of view, I'm giving unconditionally, but I know the person I'm involved with is committed, is only thinking about what they can do for me. This answers another very difficult question. The Mesillas Yesharim, Lutzato writes that the basic axiom of the Torah, the most fundamental principle of Torah, is to know that the purpose of my existence is to derive pleasure from God. That is the basic principle, that God is going to give me pleasure. That's the whole purpose of my existence, which seems to contradict what the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, in Ethics of the Father. The Mishnah says there, Yeshua, Antignus Isocho, Omer, Antignus Isocho said, out to you, Kavodim Hamashamshim Esarav Amanas the Kavod Pras. You should not be like servants that serve God in order to get a reward. You're not supposed to think about reward. And here he says that this is Yesod HaYesodis. This is the axiom of all axioms, is to know that God's going to give you pleasure. The answer is 100%. You do everything not for reward. But you have to know that you're involved in a God whose whole agenda is to give you pleasure. Otherwise, it's human sacrifice. It's the whole relationship is misunderstood. Then God didn't do me a favor. God created Hasidim because he needs robots. He wants servants. He wants service. The whole message, the whole basic mindset of Yiddishkeit is the most important principle. That's not my saying. That's what Lutzato says. This is the most important principle of Yiddishkeit, is to know that God is interested in giving me pleasure. Why is that the most important? Because otherwise everything you do is just letting yourself get destroyed. Love is to empower you to be involved in relations you're going to get stronger from. The way you get stronger is because you're involved with somebody that's their whole agenda, is to make you stronger, to empower you, to be involved in you, to help you, to want you to become a better person, a stronger person, to enjoy life more. Yeah, well, by the way, pleasure, I don't want to get into the whole thesis. We're not only talking about pleasure in this world, talking about eternal pleasure. I'm not getting into the whole Mesillas Yesharim. I don't mean that the whole purpose is in this world you're going to have pleasure. The whole purpose is to know that ultimately the relationship is to give you total pleasure. Idun HaNitzchi, eternal pleasure, eternal bliss. That's the purpose of the relationship. Even though you're not doing it for reward, because if it's not that, then all you're doing is human sacrifice. Okay, so the first principle we're saying is that the definition of love means being involved with somebody who's committed to you, who's thinking about you. You're their agenda. Anything less than that is not love. That's martyrdom. Therefore, when the Sifri says that the definition of Ahava, to love God, means not to do, to give Him totally unconditional, but part of that is knowing the Sof HaKovod Lavo, God is focused on you. And they say, and that's not so simple, because that's exactly different than all the other religions. And that's really the contrast here. That if you don't buy into that, what you're going to do is buy into the other thing, is that it's human sacrifice. Vavadtem Elohim Acherim, you're going to sacrifice, you're going to serve other gods, not other gods that are estranged from you. And there's going to be pleasure in that. You're a hero. You sacrificed yourself. You became a martyr to the cause. That's the contrast. If you do the mitzvahs, then you're involved in a God that's concerned about you. If you don't do, then you're going to get involved in idolatry, which is the way you validate yourself is by destroying yourself. That becomes the self-validation. The sacrifice, the human sacrifice, is the validation. And we're involved in a God who wants to validate us. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. I have to know God's here. Sof HaKovod Lavo, God is trying to validate me. The word kavod means honor, but the word kavod really means more than honor. The word kavod in Hebrew means heavy. When you say, like in English, somebody's a heavyweight, that means they're a person of substance. Sof HaKavod Lavo means God is trying to make me substantial. He's trying to validate me. That's what I have to know. That I'm being He's interested in validating me. I'm not doing anything because I expect something in return, but I'm involved with somebody who I know his goal is I should be validated. I'm not supposed to be sacrificed. I'm supposed to be validated. I said, this now begins to explain another fascinating thing. Let me ask you a philosophical question. God can only do good. God can't do bad. That's not a limit. God has limitations. But that's not limitation, is not an imperfection. It's only an imperfection if what he cannot do, that if he could do what he can do, he'd be better. But not being able to do something which is evil is not a imperfection of God. That's because he's perfect, therefore he can't do anything that's evil. It's like saying God can't kill himself. That's not an imperfection in God, that he can't kill himself. It's because he's mukhrach hametzius, because he has to be, and has to be is the ultimate of perfection, therefore he can't do anything that negates that. There's no, with God, anything that God can do, that being able to do would make him imperfect, is not a limitation on God. God can do everything, but he can't do anything which doing it itself would be an imperfection. God can't do evil. Let me ask the question. Could God create a man who can only live 70 years, then becomes vapor? Can God philosophically create a man? The whole creation of man is only 70 years, and afterwards you become vaporized and you cease to be. Nothing more, nothing less. I don't think God can do that. Just imagine us having 70 years of life. No more. Remember, that's not the way man was created. Man was created with the potential of living forever. This was our choice, a consequence of our doing. And even now, we still have a possibility for eternity. But I'm saying, let's say we have a world to come too. Even after this, we have a world to come, and we have eternal living. Let's say man could only live 70 years. Just imagine yourself living 70. Just imagine you know you only have 70 years, no more. It can't be 70, maybe even less. And then it's over. There's nothing afterwards. Nothing. Zero. You don't have any eternity. There's no resurrection. There's nothing. The soul doesn't live on nothing. What's your feeling of life? To me, life would be one death sentence. Wouldn't be a life living sentence. It would be a death sentence. All you would do is the moment you come into being, you would then be conscious of each day in a state of decline. Right, that would be our sense of life. Our sense of life would be a state of decline. You have 70 years, and next year, you only have the next birthday, 69 to go, 65 to go, which would mean that you would feel like, how there's somebody who has terminal illness, the doctors have already given up on, and it's, you know, well, medically, it's almost like, hey, that's not, they're alive and they're dying. That's just a death sentence on a person. They're under death. That would be, I think, the feeling of life if life was only 70 years with nothing afterwards. I don't think God could do that. I'm saying, I think philosophically he wouldn't be able to do that, because that would not be doing an act of goodness. He certainly wouldn't do it. I'm not even sure he could do it, but he certainly wouldn't do it because God only does good. He certainly wouldn't do that. When he created man, man had the potential of eternity, and even after the punishment, it didn't take away the potential of eternity. It just meant not necessarily you have to go to sleep, and then resurrection. Resurrection is one of the 13 cardinal principles of our faith, so it's always eternal existence. But let's say there would be no. He certainly wouldn't have done that, because non-eternal existence means a 70-year life sentence, a death sentence. There's nothing worse than a 70 year. It's bad enough when a person, you know, finds out 6 months before that it's all over and that they have to die. But this is already with the feeling that there's an eternal life, even this life gives you a feeling of a death sentence. Imagine if there was nothing afterwards, and everybody would be living in a sense of death. God certainly wouldn't have created man like that. That means if he created man, could God create man now without food? You're alive, and then you start starving to death from the moment you're born. We're all created at the age of 30, like Adam was. And all of a sudden, but no food. And you just feel, maybe you die in 2 weeks. Wouldn't do that either. Therefore, if God created us, he actually has an obligation to sustain us. To give us the opportunity to sustain ourselves. Because if there's no opportunity to sustain ourselves, then he didn't really do us a favor by giving us life and just watching ourselves starve to death. God said, you shall eat, be satisfied, and you should bench. V'chalta, v'savata, v'erachta. You should say grace, you should say thank you. The reason he said that is, God has an obligation to sustain us. He does not have an obligation that we should have to feel full stomach, feeling satisfied when we eat. He has an obligation to sustain us, that's all. There has to be enough food to sustain us, but not that we have to be satisfied when we eat. Therefore, God did not make it an obligation when you eat a piece of bread to say that you have to say grace. You only have to say thank you to God if you ate enough to make you feel full. And you feel full. You don't feel full. What do you got to say thank you for? You got to give me food. You're going to create me, not give me food? I want to explain now what the angels were asking. The angels were asking God, how can he show favoritism? And God said, because you said in the Torah you don't show favoritism, how can I not show favoritism? I told them that they should say grace only when they're full, and they say grace even when they eat a piece of bread. So the difference is something like this. The reason that God said you should only say grace when you're full is because anything less than that, to sustain myself, to sustain ourselves, God owes that to us. That's what I got to say thank you for. You're just paying me back what you owe me. You created me. You're not going to let me starve to death, so you have to give me the opportunity to eat. So I say thank you. I say thank you for this. You have to. This is something you owe me. You're going to create me and not give me enough food to sustain myself? That's what God said, 100%. I'm not going to ask you to say thank you. I'm going to ask you to say thank you when you had a full stomach. A full stomach, I don't owe you. I owe you. I don't owe you the pleasure of eating. I owe you the sustenance. You know, if you had a vitamin pill to keep you alive, fine. If the drink and the vitamin pill to keep you alive, that's fine. I don't have to give you the pleasure of eating. What did the Jewish people choose to do? Jewish people say, no. We want to thank you, God, even for a piece of bread. Even what you owe us, we don't want because you owe it to us. Even what you owe us, we only want. You don't owe us anything. I don't want you to feel you owe us anything. Even if from your point of view you feel you owe us, I don't want to take it as an obligation. I want to take it only because you want to give it to me. Therefore, I want to say thank you to. Love means even when you are in a relationship with somebody who owes you, let's say you divide up the division of labor in an ordinary home. The husband goes out to work, and for the most part, the wife spends most of the day taking care of the home. Good part of the day. I guess you could argue, look, husband says, I work, I come home, she owes me a dinner. I mean, just the division of labor. The wife says, listen, I work all day, he owes to make me a living. That's the beginning of destruction of a marriage, if that's the attitude. You always got to say thank you for supper, and you got to say thank you when your husband makes it. Now, it's true he owes it to you, and you owe it to him. But the base of love is that I don't want it as an obligation. I took it as because you love me, you want to take care of me, and you love me, you want to take care, and you want to take care of me. I love you, I want to take care of you, and you love me, you want to take care of me. The fact that we put an obligation in addition to the love, that could be. But I don't want it as that. I'm not interested in receiving supper because you owe it to me. I want to say thank you because I don't want it. I want it as before the obligation. I don't want it as an obligation. I want it as if I'm not, as if you're not, I'm not holding you to the obligation. In fact, I only want it if you want to give it to me. I don't want it if you feel you're doing it because it's an obligation. The definition of lo yisa shocha, lo yisa upon God, doesn't show favoritism. But we have gotten, but I have to show favoritism to them. Because favoritism means, what the beginning of the sentence is like this: God doesn't show favoritism and doesn't take a bribe. So how is, what's the context? Means he does what's fair, just. Bribe is something that we talk about justice, right? So he's doesn't show favoritism, and he doesn't take bribes. Means he does justice. You do justice to a person who deals with you on rights. Someone who says that even what you owe me, you don't have to give me unless you want to give it to me. That's not a person who's dealing with rights at all. I'm only dealing with love. I don't want it as a right. I do not want it as a right. God, you owe it to us. We don't take it as an obligation from you. We take it because you want to give us food. Even though all you gave us is bread, and obviously you owe it. That could be from your point of view. You create us, you feel it's an obligation. That's from your point of view. You can feel as obligated as you want. But from my point of view, I don't feel you owe me anything, and I take whatever you give me with great appreciation, and I'm letting you off the hook for your obligation. I'm only taking it because I understand that you want, that you're giving it to me from love, which means I am forgiving you your obligation. You want to give it to me, fine. You don't want to give it to me, it's also fine. And therefore, I'm saying thank you even for a piece of bread. It means what we've really done is discharged God from his obligation. When someone pays you what they owe you, you don't say thank you. I'm giving you what's coming to you. You borrowed $1,000. Thank you. I thank you. Usually the lender, the borrower, thanks you for lending him the money, which is a halachic problem. But that's the way it ought to be, that the borrower who did the favor. Now that you paid me back, you didn't do me a favor by paying me back. You owed that to me. What the Jewish people were saying to God, even what you owe us, you don't owe us. You don't owe us anything. We're thanking you very much, even for a piece of bread. We have a loving relationship. We don't want to be in this. It's not a business relationship. You created us. I don't know about owing. You're doing it. We're taking it because you love us. And therefore, we say thank you even on a piece of bread. But God says they're not in a business relationship with me. Not asking for their rights and privileges. So therefore, of course, I have to show them favoritism. They're dealing with me out of love. I have to deal with them out of love also. We have now a second level. The first level was that the definition is we don't have a business relationship with God. We have a loving relationship. What a loving relationship means that we don't expect anything in return for what we're doing, but we do know that he is committed to our welfare, to empowering us. So far, cover level. The second step is even what he owes us, we're not interested in collecting. And it does really interfere with love if all of a sudden you owe me, just imagine your husband coming home and saying, "What do you mean? You owe me supper." Yeah, I guess you could say, of course I owe you. Here's two cans of sardines, that you can open yourself. But I'm saying, but it's a much deeper feeling. You don't owe me anything. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And the other way also, you should deal with it. He doesn't owe you to work. And to provide. Even if he does, I don't say he doesn't, he does, but that's not the way you should view it. You should always say thank you and be very appreciative, because then it's love. The fact that he obligated himself to love, that doesn't take away from the love. It didn't start with, marriage, you don't go in, it's not a business relationship. You cook for me. It starts, I want to do everything for you and do everything for me. Then afterwards, we concretize that with obligations. But the obligations are not really the basis. It doesn't start with obligations. It starts with a feeling for each other. So the way you should maintain the relationship is the same way. Forget about the obligations. It's that I know I'm doing it because I want to cook for you, and I'm doing it because I want to be able to support you. Just that I support you, I can make more money. So I support you, and you can cook, and that you won't make as much money as me. So we'll divide up the labor the way it'll be mutually beneficial for both of us. But it shouldn't be ever a feeling of obligation. Obligation is the bane of the relationship. That destroys the relationship when it's obligation. Obligation is, it's true that I'm so committed that I love you that I'm willing to even make it an obligation. But that's not, it doesn't start, it's not a business relationship. A business relationship starts because of this, therefore I'm working, therefore you owe me a salary. Marriage relationship, even though it becomes afterwards a legal obligation, is I'm so committed to you that I'm willing to obligate myself to that. But the basis is not the obligation. The basis is the underlying feeling for you is why I'm doing it. And your feeling for me is why you're doing it. With this, I think now we begin to understand. Now, this is just the continuation of the thesis that we have a loving relationship with God, which means it's not based on obligation at all, neither way. And we never reach the obligation. We don't want it as an obligation. We don't even think he's obligated. And any obligation, forget about obligation. We just want it if you really want to give it. We have mitzvahs that are called mitzvahs kalos. Easy mitzvahs. Now, easy mitzvahs is a very hard thing to define. What do you mean, easy mitzvahs? I'll tell you the Rambam's example for an easy mitzvah. The Rambam's example, there's a Mishnah that talks about easy mitzvahs too. The Mishnah says, Havizor b'mitzvah kala k'v'chamura. A light mitzvah, you should be just as meticulous to observe as a difficult mitzvah. She'ein atoyodeya ma'askor and shom mitzvah. This is a statement from Rabbi Judah the Prince. What statement? Because you don't know the relative rewards for the mitzvahs. So on that mission, the Rambam gives him one of the examples is to know Hebrew grammar. That's a mitzvah, easy mitzvah. So still, you know now, the rule of easy mitzvah doesn't mean it's easy to do. Right? That doesn't mean because it's easy to do. But I think mitzvah's kalos means like this. I think there's a very profound insight here. Mitzvah's kalos means mitzvahs that I perceive as not being all that important to you. It's light to you. As you ask me, let's say in any relationship, let's talk about a relationship with God. Everybody understands, he says, don't do idolatry. That's serious breach of the relationship. Murder, serious breach of the relationship. Right? There's things, Shabbos, there's very serious breaches of the relationship. And I understand, therefore, he has a right to be able to insist on things that are very, very important. Then there's things that if I don't do them, is not a serious breach of the relationship. In fact, people who pick and choose mitzvahs, they have a very clear understanding of what they consider to be the important breach of the relationship, which is minor things. The minor. It has nothing to do with easy and hard. It's just minor means it's not that important to God. Not that important to him. It's not important for the maintaining the world. This is not that important. When someone that you're in a loving relationship with asks you to do something that's very important, of course you do it. Well, then they start asking you things that are not all that important to them. In most relationships, this becomes a very serious problem. You know, you could wake up an employee at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, I need an ice cream cone. It's not impossible. Your employee is going to go. If they need the job bad enough and the market is not that good for jobs and you're paying them decent compensation, they will jump out of bed 3 o'clock in the morning and bring you an ice cream cone. They obviously will do that with great resentment, great anger, frustration, probably even feel bad about themselves that they got themselves, that they're so helpless they can't, but they'll do it. They will definitely do it. You call up the same employee at 3 a.m. in the morning. My husband just had a heart attack. I need you to come wash the kids. Jumps in the car, no hesitation, happy to do it, not a doubt. Because they don't feel that you are imposing as an employer and taking advantage of their needing you, or the fact that you have the ability to retaliate if they don't... The ability to retaliate. This is a tremendous need. Tremendous need they're happy to do. Mitzvahs kalos and chamuris, I think, is exactly the same thing. Mitzvahs chamuris means things that are important to God, they'll jump and they'll do, we'll all jump and do. Mitzvahs kalos means that we don't understand it's so important, though we need them for a lot of other things, and we can't afford to jeopardize our relationship, and we have, and therefore he forces us to sweat the small stuff. What can I do? I got no choice, because if I really get him upset, he can fire me, kill me, destroy, make me sick. There's a lot. God has an enormous amount of power over us, and therefore I have to do it, but I do it with a tremendous amount of resistance and reluctance. See, that's the pshat in mitzvah she'odim dosh ba'kevav. Dosh ba'kevav doesn't mean you don't do it. Dosh ba'kevav means I do it. I step on it. I do it angrily. Just imagine the feeling this employee is going to have at 3 a.m. in the morning of, eating, okay, I want ice cream, or I'd like to see the early edition of the Times. And I was at that Broadway show last night, and I have my own opinion. I like to see that I want to go back to sleep, and I want to get the 3 o'clock, well, I think the first edition of Times is available about 3 a.m. I'd like you to go get it for me, so this way I'll be able to sleep for a few more hours. They'll do it, they're angry and resentful and resist. That's what a mitzvah kal is. That's the feeling a lot of us have about mitzvah kal. It's not all that important. Why is God hassling me? Why is he imposing upon me? Right? So the rabbis use a very strong language here. Akev, you step on. What do you step on? No one's going to be that stupid to step and antagonize God. It means you got no choice. I have to do it, but I do it in a way that I put down the mitzvah. I resent doing it. I can't stand doing it, but I have to do it. I got no choice. I got no choice over here, because if I don't do it, the retaliation and other things that I can't live without could be very forthcoming. V'hoye ekev tishmon, v'hoye, you have to do them with joy. A person that understands that God loves me and he's not taking advantage of the relationship, but he's doing it only because he cares about me, then you do it with great joy. You can do the small stuff. When you're in a loving relationship, nothing is small. Oh, your husband likes a certain kind of this. You'll run to get to this, and you'll go over there and run, and you go shopping and do it for what is like a minor thing that'll have something that maybe he'll enjoy, like one course a little better because it'll have a spice that he likes. You won't hesitate to do. You won't hesitate to do. There's nothing small when there's a relationship is predicated on love. When you don't have that feeling that it's a business relationship, you really resent the small stuff. But Hoya Ekev Tishmon means it has to be. The litmus test is, if in a loving relationship, do you do the small things with joy? Are you happy to do the small things with joy? Or do you feel it's an imposition? In any business relationship, the small things are the things that you feel the big things are what you're getting paid for. The rest you resent and you can't stand doing. I was as a simple once. I'll never forget this. There was a very wealthy fellow in town who made a simcha. I forget what the simcha was, and I was there, and he wanted everybody to start washing. It wasn't a shul, it wasn't a big crowd there. Must have been a yard site or something for his parent, yard site or something. And he wanted everybody to start washing. And Teal Shaddai was a firm guy, and his workers, they were Israelis. They knew enough about washing, and probably a lot of the American guys weren't a yarmulke, so I imagine they were maybe even firm. And it's not going fast enough for him. I saw this myself. He takes one of his workers and pushes him. Go wash! I told you to wash! I mean, that's the kind of thing I feel a guy's in prison, a prisoner feels that. But he really was. He's shackled. The job shackles him. He's stuck in prison. The job can be very imprisoning. And here you have a boss who's taking advantage of that feeling. Can you imagine, physically pushing a person because you want him to wash now, and if he doesn't wash, he doesn't want to wash, if he owes it to you to wash, you're working for me. What do you mean you're not going to wash? He didn't have to say that. But that was certainly what he was. There's a tremendous, tremendous hostility when you push a person to do things that are really relatively unimportant to you. Vaya Ekev Tishmon means that those have to be done with joy. If they're done with joy, then there's a tremendous feeling of love. We, our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to be only a love relationship. It starts knowing we do nothing because we want as to create in him a sense of obligation. We give to him unconditionally, except we know that he loves us. We're his agenda. That was the first principle. That was the pasuk of V'hoyim v'la'avas Hashem sofa kovid lovo. The second principle is even that which he owes us, we forgive his obligation, and we only want it out of love. And the litmus test of this is, what we're saying now is, do I do the small things? You're in love with somebody, you do the small things. If it's a business relationship, you only do the things you're getting paid for, the things that are important enough that you think justify your compensation. For all your ache of Tishman has to be done with a great, great deal of simcha, a great deal of joy. And actually, Chazal tells us another thing here. B'shomar lecha es habris ves hachesed, God will give you the covenant and the chesed and the kindness that he promised Avram, that Asher nishba l'avosecha, he promised your forefathers. So the Yerushalmi says on this sentence, in the Jerusalem Talmud says on this sentence, that God is the proof that the Jewish people have chesed. God will give you chesed is a proof that the Jewish people have chesed. What's the proof that the Jewish people have chesed? It's the sentence saying the opposite. Not that the Jews have chesed, but God gives us chesed. God will give us his kindness. How can we establish from here that we have kindness? That the Mefarshim asked that question. The way we're saying that question is not an issue. The whole idea of doing the small things can only be done out of an act of kindness. I love you, therefore I'm doing for you. And that's why the quid pro quo is, God does for you also. There's no way that you can do small things with joy unless you really love somebody. You can do small things with joy. Big things you'll do because the reward is worth it. But small things is too much of an imposition on your life that the compensation doesn't justify. You do the small things with joy, then you know that becomes a test of love. Now we know pshat in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says you don't know the reward of the mitzvahs. And therefore, you have to be careful to observe the small mitzvahs, the easy mitzvahs, the hard. What do you mean? The big mitzvahs have to have more reward. I mean, let's not be stupid. The big mitzvahs have to have more reward. What are we supposed to pretend that something unimportant has reward? The answer is there can be more reward. In a small mitzvah, because the act of doing it has more loving. Well, really, what does create? What is really more? What do you get more back for? The fact that you did something that's important to God, or the fact that he knows you love him? The person in the middle of the night goes to come to your house to watch the kids because you have a medical emergency. Okay, that's very nice, but there's probably 100 other people you can call. Somebody who's happy, honey, don't worry, I'll go out and get you pickles and ice cream. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that's who do you feel closer to? Who you feel more committed to? The person that you called up to watch your kids for a medical emergency, or the person that was nice or kind or loving enough to go out in the middle of the night to get you a whim? It's a very big issue. So certainly we can't know. Certain times you give for what you receive, and other times what you receive, the amount of love you receive by someone who does something like that for you, maybe is greater than the amount of help that you received for the medical emergency. When someone is happy in the middle of the night to get you something that you really want, crave, a cigarette, ice cream, whatever it is, that person, maybe what they gave you wasn't all that important, but what they gave you, the love that they did it with the joy that gave you maybe more than the person who watched your kids during a medical, because they gave you love. And therefore, that's what the Mishnah says. You really can't measure the two. The amount of love in a small thing is greater than in a big thing. And who knows what rewards come for? The rewards come for what the mitzvah represents, or the rewards come for the amount of love of the person doing the mitzvah, the amount of love you have for God, or is the mitzvah, or the reward comes for the actual accomplishment of the mitzvah. I don't know. But not that I don't know. I say Rabbi Yehuda Anossi says, none of us know. Who knows? You can't know. Maybe sometimes like this, therefore you better be careful to do everything. Be careful to do the important things, and be careful to be very enthusiastic about doing the small things, because you may be getting more credit for doing something small because the amount of love that expresses. I have a feeling that somebody who fasts on Tzom Gedalia may get more reward than somebody who fasts on Yom Kippur. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. Because the percentage of people that fast on Yom Kippur is probably 100 times the amount of people who fast on Tzom Gedalia. If you do that with your love, this, maybe there's more reward. Can't tell. No, it's certainly not as important. But the amount of love, the amount of dedication, devotion that shows may be greater than the amount of devotion that fasting on Yom Kippur shows. The main thesis we're saying this morning is that in a loving relationship, be very careful to make sure that everything is based on the feelings and not to highlight the sense of obligation. Once you're starting to do it, you owe it to me. The next thing is call the lawyer. That's the next step. Call the lawyer. Marriage is not if it is a business relationship, it's not a marriage. Maybe you don't need a lawyer. Maybe you just need some way of, way of settling the differences and staying in the marriage, but that's, the marriage is born. Not the Torah marriage. The love is out of the marriage already. When you owe me this, I owe you this. That's gone. You've taken it from a love and reduced it to the obligations. You reduced it to a business. Even though it's true, there are obligations, and you should never forget that there are obligations. That's not the basis. That's that I obligated myself to I committed myself, but really, why I'm doing it and why I want to receive it is not because you owe it to me to go out and work. I want to receive it because I know you love me.